Do we have a new role in medicine for the U.S. Postal Service?
Screening for depression in adults.
And yet another role for the Postal Service.
And the prevalence of characteristics of physicians that are prone to malpractice claims.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on January 29th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I served up these two as, do we have a new role for the United States Postal Service? So let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine, a study taking a look at mailing people devices so that they could screen for colorectal cancer and the efficacy of that.
Since colorectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the United States, and it's preventable if we screen, we'd like to be able to do it in a way that is acceptable to individuals, and they will continue the recommended follow-up. In low-risk individuals, it's been suggested that screening for blood in the stool can be effective, and that's using fecal occult blood testing, called FOBT, or fecal immunochemical test, or FIT. And by the way, the latter is a little bit more sensitive and a little bit more specific. So how can you do this? Mail them these little kits where they can test it and mail it back in. Do they complete it? And will they continue to do that? And how effective is it? And that's what this study assessed by looking at 323,000 health plan members in Kaiser Permanente in California. They had one of these FIT cards mailed to them. And then those who returned them, they had them mailed for a total of 4 years. Of the patients who were invited for screening, about a half participated by returning the first card. By the way, if they did that, they were very likely to do that over the next 4 years, about 75 to 85% of individuals. And the test was pretty effective in identifying people with colorectal cancer. If it was positive, they went on a colonoscopy, and there was a high rate of the colonoscopy being positive. This demonstrated that this FIT screening was associated with a high sensitivity for screening for colorectal cancer, a high adherence to the annual follow-up screening. So this gives a new term to stamp out cancer.
Boo. But you know, that was obligatory, wasn't it? Does this just require a fecal swab, or what do we do? And then we just adhere this to the card and mail it off?
Yes, it requires just taking a small piece of the fecal material, putting on the card, and then sending it off.
These, of course, are the kinds of things that we've talked about on a multitude of occasions, something less invasive than colonoscopy in order to perform that initial screen. Clearly, the methodology is also getting better. So I'm guessing that these kinds of screening methods are going to become even better and even more practical in the future. Would you participate in such a program?
This is most applicable to either average or low-risk individuals. People that have had a history of colorectal cancer or have a history of it in the family or have a history of polyps at young ages, these individuals are considered to be high risk and colonoscopy would be recommended for them. But the average risk patient, this is certainly an alternative to colonoscopy, which is done on average every 7 to 10 years.
I like it. Since we're talking about the U.S. Postal Service then, which, let's face it, a struggling body. So if we can somehow get them involved with medicine, this may be a good thing. We're going to turn to JAMBA Internal Medicine, the efficacy of mailing out nicotine patches to people who are attempting to quit smoking cigarettes.
We know that nicotine replacement therapy, or NRT, is effective in helping people stop smoking, people that have a desire to do so. Now, usually when that's administered, they're given nicotine replacement therapy, and they're also oftentimes given counseling about how to proceed with smoking cessation. What this study did was to identify 1,000 patients who were smoking, and they asked them, if you were given free nicotine replacement therapy, would you use it to stop smoking? Do you desire to do so? And these individuals said yes. So on half of those individuals, they provided free nicotine patches. The other half, they provided them nothing, and then they followed them over the course of several months. Those that received nicotine replacement therapy in the mail and nothing more, it went from about 3.5% to about 7 or 8%.
Good news. That's an easy strategy, I think, and that perhaps in combination with other things that patients can employ themselves, like perhaps CBT online or something like that, may actually increase that rate more.
It is. And obviously, this is very cost effective. The unique thing about this is they were provided free. So you already selected a group of individuals that wanted to stop and just needed this. So it also proves that nicotine replacement therapy in and of itself, without any other combination therapy, is beneficial in helping smoking cessation.
Excellent. Let's turn now to screening, to something that's been percolating for quite a long time. The USPSTF this week, as featured in JAMA, recommended depression screening for a large swath of the population.
And this is their second set of recommendations. The first one came out in 2009. What they noted at that particular time was that depression not only affects the individual, but it affects families, it affects communities, it affects healthcare at large. And this screening can be helpful identifying those that have depressive symptoms, but we didn't have either good data that treating these individuals in a primary care setting was beneficial, nor did we have enough treatment options available to individuals. Now that we have good data that we can provide excellent therapy in the primary care setting and is effective, the new recommendations go a lot further in saying that all adults should be screened. By the way, that's done with just a routine questionnaire that's pretty good in identifying those with depression. About an 80% sensitivity and about a 50% specificity. Those that have a family history should be screened at least on an annual basis. And those that are seen sporadically by their physicians once every 2 or 3 or 4 years, they should be screened at that time as well. The other recommendation, as you're aware, Elizabeth, that women who are pregnant also receive screening, because we know that cognitive behavioral therapy can reduce depressive symptoms and affect remission both in pregnancy and postpartum as well. Again, it's with a questionnaire, a little bit different questionnaire, but it's very good at identifying those with depression.
The controversy continues, however, with regard to medication in women who are pregnant.
And the recommendation here is that cognitive behavioral therapy be the first line therapy. It can cause remission of symptoms in somewhere between 20 and 60% of women, and it has no adverse effects on the fetus.
What do you think about this, Rick? Do you think that such a strategy is going to net more people with depression who should be treated? Clearly, one of the things that is related to depression is this huge increase in suicide, especially among middle-aged white males that we've borne witness to recently.
In my opinion, undoubtedly, doing routine screening on everybody will allow us to identify individuals that have depression. So I think it does offer a benefit. Here's one of the things you and I have talked about. There are so many responsibilities falling on the primary care physician at a time where we're squeezing the time they have to see patients. But because this is a major behavioral health issue across the United States, I think it's imperative. And now that we know that primary care setting can deliver effective therapy, I think this is very important.
I just offer one final caveat, and that's that this at-risk population, as I cited, middle-aged white males, don't have a whole lot of interaction with the healthcare system in general.
Your point's well taken. That's why if they're seen sporadically, they should be screened every time they see the physician.
Okay. Let us turn then to our final study for this week. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine, taking a look at that thing that's of great interest to physicians, of course, malpractice claims.
This study took the approach that if we can identify the prevalence of malpractice claims and the characteristics of physicians that are prone to them, we can prevent them. The claims oftentimes identify subpar care delivered or injury or death associated with medical care, and how can we avoid that as well? To address this, they analyzed over 66,000 claims that were paid in the National Practitioner Data Bank. And this involved over 54,000 physicians over a 10-year period. And here's what they found out. It was a very small number of physicians that accounted for most of the paid claims. Approximately 1% of all physicians accounted for 32% of all paid claims. 84% of those physicians, there was just one claim. 16% had at least two claims. 4% had at least three claims paid. It wasn't residents, it was mostly non-residents. It was a little bit older physicians. There were certain specialties that were associated with an increased risk of claims.
Very interesting. Of course, you already foreshadowed, and I want to know, and I'm going to guess. With respect to specialties, OB, I would think, is high up there, but maybe you're going to surprise me.
Okay, so half the claims were due to four specialty groups: internal medicine, OBGYN, general surgery, and general practice or family medicine. The specialty associated with the least number of claims was actually psychiatry.
I actually am a little bit surprised at the relative paucity of claims. I would have thought that over that period, there would have been significantly more.
There are oftentimes claims made, at least 70% of them are dismissed. Of the ones that were paid, only 3% were paid to satisfy a court case. 97% of those were settled out of court. This doesn't give us a lot of insight into the merit of the claim. This study is provocative in many aspects.
Certainly, it's one aspect of us trying to get our arms around medical costs. And what does this study tell us about that with regard to adding to the burden of what medicine costs? Where does this fit?
Some of the data helps us to be better at predicting who is at a high risk for further claims. That's a small number of individuals, but if individuals have two or three or four, and sometimes as many as six claims, if we can identify who those individuals are and intervene, especially if they're delivering subpar care that injures patients, that's very important.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to do the colorectal cancer screening methodology through the U.S. Postal Service. You can tell I'm really tickled by that on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.